Along those lines, I do want to mention really quickly that this teaching here in about 10 minutes does contain a description of gun violence. And if that is something that is going to be traumatic for you, I just want to give you a little bit of a heads up right after I talk about the first set of verses. That's going to be where that happens. So if that makes you feel unsafe, please take precautions to go out and get a donut during that time or do something else. So just want to give you a heads up. On a much lighter note, I did want to ask you all a question this morning. Has anyone in here ever made a really bad prediction? that anyone actually fess up to it? Maybe, okay. Maybe it was something like, March Madness was getting ready to start and you picked a team to win the whole thing and they went out first round. Or maybe in more seasonal times, with right now being baseball season, you predicted that the St. Louis Cardinals would have something that resembled a major league team. As an Atlanta fan, I can say that. if you've ever made a really bad prediction, the good news is that you're in good company. History is riddled with people who have made really bad decisions. Here's a couple of them that I wanted to share with you. The first one is this, that John Elfrith Watkins, who was the curator at the Smithsonian in 1900, said, "In the year 2000, we will see the demise of the letters C, X, and Q." Didn't happen. The second one is this. This is from Henry Morton, who was the president of Stevens Institute of Technology, who said this about Edison's light bulb. He said, "Everyone acquainted with the subject will recognize it as a conspicuous failure." And then in slightly more recent times, in 1948, this was said by Daryl Zanuck, who was a movie producer at 20th Century Fox. He said, "Television won't be able to hold on to any market it captures after the first 6 months. People soon get tired of staring at a plywood box every night." I kind of wonder what Zanuck would have said about the ways that we stare not at our plywood boxes, right, but at our titanium boxes or our plastic boxes that we might have right here. Well, I made a similar prediction to this in the early 2000s. I had just started in ministry. I had my first ever paying ministry job. I was the youth pastor at First Baptist Stratford. And I was doing youth ministry type things, like having people to McDonald's where I would buy them Cokes and French fries. And as we were sitting there one day, all of a sudden, the student reached in their pocket and grabbed their phone, which, remember, back then, phones kind of looked like this. Yeah. They grabbed and they started just punching a bunch of buttons. And I didn't understand what they were doing, but then another student across the table looked at their phone and punched some more buttons. I said, "What are you doing?" And they said, "Chris, we're texting." And I said, "What? You're literally sitting across the table from each other. You could just talk." And they're like, no. And they said, "But there's this thing that, like, if maybe someone's not sitting right here, maybe they're like, maybe it's my friend, I could just send them a text. And it only costs 10 cents a text." Remember that, by the way? They were like, "I can just send a text to them, and then they can send me back a text." And I was like, "But you could also just call them." And I was just like, this texting thing is just never going to catch on. Like, it is so ridiculous. Why would anyone ever do this? I heard a comedian quip recently that calling this a phone now is kind of like calling a Mercedes-Benz a cup holder. I mean, it has one. But if you're anything like me, it's probably one of your least used apps. And the thing for me that was the problem at that point was this, that at that moment, I realized as a young 20-something-year-old, I did not understand teenagers anymore. They were speaking a completely different language than I got, and it started to scare me a little bit. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't predict what they were going to do. And my guess is that you've probably had a similar experience, probably with teenagers. But even if it wasn't with a teenager, maybe it was at a job interview and you got asked a question and you just had no idea what to say. Or maybe you were out on a date and the person sitting across from you said something that just completely shocked you. And maybe, unfortunately, for many people, that doesn't happen there, but it happens in places that we are supposed to trust, right? like faith communities, where someone told you growing up, oh, God loves you no matter what, it's unconditional. And then they didn't anymore. And not only does that lead to confusion, but sometimes way worse, it leads to significant hurt. Today, we're going to be starting a new series here called Find Your People. And over the next 4 weeks, Pastor Philip and I are going to be sharing about how we create and curate and cultivate the spaces and the ways that we can find our people. It is such an important space right now. As the song the band just sang talked about, we need to have those people who will call our bluff and those people who will lend a hand. Those people that we can predict that they're going to be there time after time. Last year, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy said that loneliness isn't just a uniquely American problem. He was talking about the fact that globally, we are facing a loneliness epidemic. And he said the issue in the United States is actually that what has happened is that many of the things that we used to do are no longer there. Less people are doing things like playing recreational sports with each other or joining a faith community. And so he said this. He said that we're seeing more forces that take us away from one another and fewer of the forces that bring us together. And I think there's a real issue here. And it's not just the things that we would normally associate, whether it's good things for many of us, things like maybe working from home or the things where we're like, well, maybe I don't have to see someone when I go through the checkout line at Price Cutter, or whether it's more serious things of just, I don't know how to connect with people. I don't have those spaces anymore. So in that place, we're often stuck asking ourselves, how do we do this? Like, how do we just get to a place that we can find people that we can relate to, that we can call, that can be our emergency contact in our phone? The Department of Health and Human Services details that there are three main components when we are developing these types of connections, the type that bring us together. They say the three vital components are the structure, the function, and the quality of these relationships. And today we're gonna spend most of our time just talking about the structure. Like, how do we create those spaces that we can find relationship with people? Because I truly believe that once we can create the structure, the function and the quality can follow from there. But it's often so hard for us to create those spaces to begin with that we never get to the type of relationships that we want. Fortunately for us, Jesus does a really good job detailing how this happens. It's in a story that we read in the Christian New Testament in the book of John chapter 4. And so today, what we're going to do is we're going to spend a little bit of time looking at this story and seeing how Jesus found his people, how other people found their people through Jesus, and maybe how we can find those types of quality relationships by creating the spaces, following after the path of love, the path of Jesus that he took. It's a story, like I said, that takes place in John chapter 4 of the New Testament, and it's actually the only place in the entire Bible that we read this story, okay? So I'm going to read a little bit of it to you. It starts off this way in verse 1, saying that the Pharisees, which remember were the religious leaders of the day, the religious teachers, heard that Jesus was making and baptizing more followers than John, although Jesus himself did not baptize people, but his followers did, and Jesus knew that the Pharisees had heard about him. So he left Judea and went back to Galilee. I do need to backtrack just a little bit, actually, before we go too far, and to say this. While this is the only time in the Bible that this entire story is told, it's not the only place that this part of the story is told. It just is the only time that it's told in a positive way. You see, John seems to have this idea that Jesus was being chased out of town because he was too popular. That he was baptizing too many people. It's almost like the paparazzi were chasing Jesus, being like, can I get your autograph, Jesus? And he felt like he needed to leave. But in other places where it shows up, like in the book of Mark, which most scholars believe was actually the first of the Gospels that Matthew and Luke just kind of like copied. He has a kind of different take on why Jesus left. In Mark 1:14, it says it this way. It says that after John was put in prison, Jesus went into Galilee preaching the good news from God. And the word that Mark uses here, it's a Greek word, because remember, the New Testament was mostly written in Greek. It's the word paradidomi, and it's the same word that is used other places for things like when Judas betrayed Jesus, or when someone would be put in prison awaiting execution, okay? So John has it as this really maybe positive thing, like Jesus is getting too popular. The other authors seem to say, like, maybe Jesus was causing too much trouble and was going to be put in prison. But regardless of which of the two reasons why Jesus might have been leaving, it felt very much like the place where Jesus was becoming unsafe. And so that's the first thing I want to share with you this morning, is that often we seek our people because of where we're coming from. Often we seek our people because of where we're coming from. Regardless of which of the two stories or the motivations of why Jesus was leaving, it's very clear that Jesus felt like he needed to get out of Dodge, right? That Jesus needed to leave. For me, I experienced a similar situation just over a year ago here. It was right after I had shared with people that I was going to be leaving education and coming on to the venues full-time. And I was still going around telling some of my colleagues in the debate community that I was no longer going to be a debate coach, that I was going to go be a pastor. And there was this situation at a debate tournament that was at Glendale High School last year, where near the end of the debate tournament, when most of the students had left and we were down to only a couple hundred students and maybe about 60 or 70 adult volunteers, that those of us that worked for SPS that were there that day got a phone call that there was an active shooter. There had been a domestic dispute at the apartment complex just north of the campus, and the gun person had been driving around the parking lot with a gun. I will tell you, by the way, for those of you who have kids in SPS, the training that we received as SPS educators was awesome. We took immediate action. We got the people where they were supposed to go. Everyone was safe. And very fortunately, the gunman never came into the building. We kept him outside. The police came and apprehended him. And everyone from the tournament left safely. But in that moment, I needed to get out. My phone had run out of battery. And I just knew, I didn't know where I needed to go, but I knew that I could no longer be in that building right that second. And so I drove home, and I saw Morgan and our dog, Sander, who came up. And you know how dogs are just amazing about no matter what's going on, they just know you, right? Sander wouldn't leave my side for several days. In the short term, what it meant is that I needed to go get help. So I started going to therapy. And I went to months of therapy so that I could even do things like go into Walmart and not feel weird looking around the corner aisle. I do want to say this. With May being Mental Health Awareness Month, it is so important that if you are struggling with mental health, that you get professional help. Do not listen to people like John MacArthur, who this week, by the way, said things like ADHD or PTSD are sinful. They are not. They are health issues, okay? If you are struggling with mental health, go get help. It's important. And by the way, going to a pastor is not the same thing as going to a therapist. Many pastors, many rabbis, many imams that I know are great people who are trying really hard to direct in spiritual directions. But we are not trained therapists. Go seek professional help. It is so important that we break down the stigma and the shame that can come from needing mental help. In the same way that I felt like I needed to get out of that situation, I know that many of us are in spaces, maybe right now, maybe you're watching online and you're thinking, my goodness, I am in a space where I just need to get out. I'm in an abusive relationship. I'm in a space where there's a lot of toxicity. And I just want to let you know that if you're in a space where maybe you're not even comfortable coming in here yet, but you have found a way to get out of the place, that is the first step. And I am so proud of you. It can take a lot of courage to just leave. And so I just want to tell you that you're doing great. That I am proud of you, that if you've taken that first step to get out of that toxicity, I'm so proud of you. And whether that toxicity is physical, emotional, spiritual, mental, or other reasons that it's just getting to be too much, that's the first step to finding our people, is to know where we're coming from. But for many of us, and I would actually even go as far as to say for most of us, once we have left the space of toxicity, of abuse, of problems, whatever that looks like, there has to be a next step. I talk to people quite regularly who are in the process of untangling their faith or of deconstructing, and they kind of get to this space and they're like, Chris, I just don't know what to do next. I know that where I was wasn't good, but I think I might go back. Because at least there I had structure for my kids, or at least there I had friends. And I see that wrestle of like, what do I do? And so here's the second thing I want to tell you is this, that not only is it from when we come from a place, but second of all, we find our people when we know where we're going to. We find our people when we know where we're going to. I find it fascinating, by the way, to see the way that great partnerships throughout history have paired up. For example, Larry Page and Sergey Brin. They met because Larry was getting ready to start attending Stanford, and Sergey was a rollerblading tour guide of San Francisco. And the two of them got together and started hanging out and formed a little company that I think is going to become something someday called Google. Seemed to work out okay. Or a personal favorite of mine, Penn and Teller, met because Penn Jillette, who was a high school dropout, decided that he would go buy a stereo. And as he was standing in the stereo store talking to the person, he was literally spending all of the money that he had saved up for the stereo. The salesperson said, you know what? I have a high school Latin teacher that you might like to meet by the name of Mr. John Teller. And they got introduced, and somehow or another, this 19-year-old high school dropout named Penn Jillette convinced a 27-year-old high school Latin teacher who had tenure to quit his job and join the Asparagus Valley Cultural Society. And nearly 50 years later, they have been one of the top headliners in Vegas for a long time. It's wild, the way that we meet our people. But you know, it's amazing to me when people meet people that oftentimes the way that that happens the easiest is when we're youngest, right? When we're a kid, maybe we're in middle school and we're in science class and our teacher says, hey, I need you to dissect this frog. And as we're sitting there like slicing open the abdomen with our partner who we just met, we look at them and we say, we're best friends now, aren't we? And you are for like two class periods or maybe for life, right? And we hope or we wish that the same thing would happen when we become adults. But it doesn't, does it? In fact, I was just thinking this last week about the reality that for so many people, as adults, the way that we find our people is when our kids are doing something together, right? We find that our kid plays softball with your kid, or our kid's in horse showing with your kid. And then at the end of that, like, okay, well, we have something in common, so maybe we can be friends. It is interesting to me, by the way, that the path of Christianity, which is largely based around the life of a man who was single and didn't have kids, struggles so much to help adults who are single and don't have kids. And it's not just the church. The entirety of society is not built that way, right? We struggle a lot in helping people meet people. But I think Jesus has a really good way to do this. And so I want to share with you the next set of verses that come out in John chapter 4. It says this, "But on the way, he," meaning Jesus, "had to go through the country of Samaria. And in Samaria, Jesus came to a town called Sychar, which is near the field Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus was tired from his long trip, so he sat down beside the well. It was about 12 o'clock noon when a Samaritan woman came up to the well to get some water. And Jesus said to her, 'Please give me a drink.'" Now, both Jesus and the woman had a reason to go to the well that day. The woman needed to get water. And the word that it uses here in verse 4 to talk about why Jesus had to go to the well is the word that we transliterate, D-E-I. And it has kind of a unique phrase to say that he had to go there. It's not he had to go there because it was on the way. It was way out of the way for him. And it's not even like that he had to go like you're sitting in the back of a minivan on a long road trip and you got to go. Instead, it was this sort of like moral obligation that he had. Like he was drawn, that he couldn't not go. I think there's something inside of us that says like we need connection, whether we are super introverted or super extroverted, whether we have lots of friends or we're involved in lots of things or whether we're not, we have this need, it feels like, to meet around other people. And so I think that's why so many people join different groups today, right? Whether it's CrossFit or a ukulele club or a church. But the main thing is, I think, that we're looking for connections. We're looking for someone that we know that we can depend on. I am so thankful here at the venues for the ways that people like Laura was sharing, by the way, that she has found her people here. A couple of weeks ago, I asked just about 36 people, hey, would you tell me why you started coming to the venues or what keeps you here? And I want to share with you three of them. The first one said this. They said, "The venues helps our community without ever asking or requiring anything in return. The venues provides meals and service throughout our community without any strings, helping us for the sake of helping people, not just to grow the numbers of our services or even try and evangelize to our community. We are just meeting the immediate needs when we can." I'm so thankful for people like Kim and others who organize weekly times where people get together and feed our unsheltered friends, because one of the things about serving people is that we all have a desire in our heart to be part of something bigger than ourselves. And here at the venues, you can find that place to find your people. The second person said this. They said, "People show up here knowing that they are loved and that they belong and that we care about them just as they are." Just this week, I was talking to someone who said they were driving by Battlefield and saw the sign. Said, "We're not for everyone because we're for everyone." I kind of think when I see it, I'm part of everyone. Maybe this could be a place that I could find people. And I think that this is the notion there, that when you come here, you are celebrated for who you are. You are loved for who you are. No strings attached. No, you have to live this way. You have to love this way. You have to vote this way. You are loved and celebrated and affirmed and encouraged because of who you are, period. And I love that. The third one came in from Facebook without being asked, and this is what they said. They said, "I'm not a Christian anymore, and I haven't been to church in years, but I stumbled on this page, and I'm currently sobbing because I've never truly seen a church that seems like it genuinely loves people. I'm from the Ozarks area and moved to Portland several years ago, and this is not something I see even there. My heart is overflowing with emotions. I'm so grateful to know this church exists." Yeah. Yeah, give yourselves a hand, by the way. You, because when people come here, the number of times that I meet people, and maybe people have seen Philip or myself or someone on stage, and they're like, "Hey, you know why I came here? Because my friend invited me." Because I know that there are people who genuinely love and care for each other, and I've never met you before, but I met this person who literally loved me just where I was. And so thank you. Whitney shared a sign with me this week that said this: "There are places you haven't been where you already belong and people you haven't met who will make you feel like home." That's you, by the way. That's you. Like creating the spaces and places where people can already belong right where they are. It's interesting, as I searched for who wrote this, I couldn't find it. No one knows who said that, and maybe that's the point, right? Is that it's not about getting the credit for it. It's just about loving people where they are. You see, we want to move to a place that is predictable, where we know we can be safe. We want to know that we will be loved, that there's a place that we can ask questions and love the people that we love and meet the needs that we see. Jesus here has a need for water. The woman has a need to fill her bucket. And in that space, they find each other. And that's where we finish up today with this notion that finding our people allows us to be known. Finding our people allows us to be known. I want you to see how the rest of this interaction goes. It says that the woman said, I am surprised that you ask me for a drink since you are a Jewish man and I'm a Samaritan woman, because Jewish people are not friends with Samaritans. And Jesus said, if you only knew the free gift of God and who it is that is asking you for water, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. And the woman said to him, sir, give me this water so I will never be thirsty again, and I won't have to come back here to get more water. And Jesus said to her, go get your husband and come back here. And the woman answered, I have no husband. And Jesus said to her, you are right to say you have no husband. Really, you've had five husbands, and the man you live with now is not your husband. You told the truth. And the woman said, sir, I can see that you're a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped on this mountain, but you say that Jerusalem is the place where we must worship. Now, normally, when people talk about this text, they hear about how Jesus tells this woman that he is living water, and they make the entire teaching some notion about eternal life. And I think that that's fine. I think that that's okay to talk about what happens after you die. But while that's often very important, I think that we devalue the path of following Jesus if we only see the story about something that happens when we die. Instead, I wonder, and I could be way wrong here, by the way, but I wonder what it would look like if instead of thinking about this story only as about the afterlife, if we thought about what it means for the here life. Look at what happens when they meet each other in this space. Jesus sees her and asks her for water despite knowing that she's from a hostile culture. And when he sees her, he recognizes something in this woman that is pretty amazing. But it is probably not the same thing that many of us were taught growing up. You see, when he sees her for who she is, I was taught growing up that he saw her as this woman of loose morals. That this is a story all about how Jesus loves the sexually deviant. But I think what actually happened here is maybe that she was outcast, not because she was a bad person, but rather because society had put so many rules and regulations that were different for women than they are for men, and she had been systemically oppressed. You see, there were lots of rules at that time, things like the fact that a man could ask for a divorce for nearly any reason, but a woman couldn't ask for one at all. And in fact, one of the main reasons that a man could ask for a divorce was if the woman was barren. And so it's entirely possible in this text that Jesus looks at this woman and says, my goodness, the systems and the society that have been around you have continuously been oppressing you and pushing you down. And yet, every single time you've managed to get your way up and you come back here to take care of yourself and your family, just as you are. I love you. I think that there's a reality that we have often looked at this as some kind of a distant text, and it's not. This is not something that ended in the time of Jesus where there was no more oppression now or something like that. I wish I could say that equality was something that we have achieved, but it isn't, right? I mean, I just read this week, this statistic, that according to Deloitte, women in the United States in 2024 pay more than $15 billion more in medical cost and receive more than $1.34 billion less in coverage. And to fix this, it would cost the average employer $1 per month per employee. $1. We continue to live in a space that continues to systemically oppress and marginalize people. And it's not just women either, right? Like, there are all kinds of marginalized communities that society continues to push to the side. Our queer siblings, our unsheltered community, our friends who are single or single again. those who choose or don't choose or are unable to have children, those who need accommodations, amongst others, those who have been excluded from the church for so long. And I wonder if it's possible that in that space, the way that we are known is that Jesus comes and looks at us and says, I see you. I see the way that you're battling against this form of systemic oppression, and I love you right there. How does Jesus know this about this woman? I have no idea. And no one does. I don't even know if this is a literal story. I mean, John wasn't there. Who knows, right? But what it does seem like is that he was able to meet her and meet her needs right then. The Department of Health and Human Services lists off two ways that these happen. They are through connecting through tiny moments and nurturing your niche. And so we know what this looked like in Samaria 2,000 plus years ago. But what's it look like in Springfield in 2024? I don't know exactly what it looks like for you. I can tell you what it looks like for me. What it looks like for me right now is Tuesdays. I love Tuesdays. I just love them. I do. I love Tuesdays. And part of the reason is this. At 6:30 on Tuesday night, I go over to a friend's house and we play Dungeons and Dragons. Until 9 o'clock at night. And then at 9 o'clock at night, I go over to a different friend's house. And we sit on his porch. And when it's really cold outside, there's a space heater. And there's a ceiling fan for when it's warm. And we sit around and we just talk. These two communities don't have anything in common, realistically. In one, we pretend like we're wizards and elves and we chase dragons in this mythical world. In this other group, some people drink bourbon and some people drink beer and some drink diet soda. And there was one time during the winter where we had the space heater on and it melted one of the blades of the ceiling fan. And in those groups, there are people who are pastors and people who are atheists. There are people who are democratic socialists and libertarians and everything in between. There are people who have all kinds of different belief systems. And yet, when someone in one of those groups loses a job, we make sure their needs are met. When there's a wedding and someone needs to carpool, we figure that out amongst ourselves. And when there's an emergency in the middle of the night and you need to have someone to drop off your kids with who you know will love those kids, we call each other in like the most positive form of relationship that I can imagine. You see, it's these tiny planned moments each week that allow us to build the relationships that allow us to be connected in this ever-complicated world. In the story, Jesus and this woman connect over water and getting water, and it seems that this changes the woman's trajectory forever. She leaves there and goes and talks to her entire community and says, I found this person who knows me for who I am. The good news for us is this. We do not have to be able to predict everything about someone else in order to do this. History is littered with the reality that we're not good at it anyway. But it's in those moments of building that structure of connection that we're able to actually predict each other. Here at the venues, we have a slew of ways that this can happen. Things like dinners for eight, things like our LGBTQI plus community group, things like Women's Warriors that meet on an ongoing basis to see each other and form those connections. Soon we'll be starting up things like in the fall we'll have another next level situation. We'll go through Faith After Doubt and our Venues Values class that is meeting right after here. It's spaces that you form those initial relationships with. The important thing with these is not the form of the structure, but it is the fact that those structures allow people to form those types of quality relationships to where we can truly be known. I am so thankful for this community that allows us to completely and truly be known.